As far as his playing for you is concerned, as soon as he has learned the proper fingering and can play a piece in the correct time, and the notes too, more or less accurately, then please concentrate on the interpretation with him. And when he has gotten to that point, don't let him stop playing just because he makes minor mistakes. Instead, point them out to him when he has finished playing the piece. I've done very little teaching, but I've always worked on that principle. It soon develops musicians, which, after all, is a major objective of this art, and it is less wearing for both master and student. That's Beethoven giving some suggestions about how to learn to play a piano sonata, writing in 1817 to Carl Czerny, who was teaching Beethoven's nephew Carl. I'm Norman Gilliland.
And I'm Emily Auerbach. This is University of the Year.
When it comes to playing those 32 piano sonatas of Beethoven's, where's the best place to begin? How do we hear Beethoven's style evolving over the course of the sonatas? And what does it take to play all 32 of them? Our guest is Christopher Taylor, professor of piano at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He's performing those 32 sonatas from memory. It's about 11 hours worth in a series of concerts over the course of about 2 months at Mills Concert Hall in Madison.
And welcome to University of the Air.
Thank you very much.
I saw in an interview that you said having to do the 32 sonatas was like climbing Mount Everest. Can you tell us how so?
I suppose, in a sense, supposedly the reason for people like Hillary intending to climb Everest was because it was there. I suppose there's something like that going on with the Beethoven sonatas. It represents sort of one's culminating achievement in a way as a pianist. I think they're so fundamental to the repertoire. Of course, some of them are more important than others, and you know, there are a couple that are even essentially works for students and works that Beethoven, to some extent, repudiated, didn't intend to publish. I'm thinking in particular of the little sonatinas, Opus 49. So in a sense, there's something arbitrary about playing minor works like that. But at the same time, it's important to see sort of the whole breadth of Beethoven's output. And the piano sonatas are certainly a good place for an overview of who Beethoven is. I mean, since there are 32 of them, more than there are symphonies or string quartets or practically any genre.
And written over the course of a fair number of years, so representing his development pretty thoroughly.
Absolutely, absolutely. There's a slight bias towards the early part of his life in the sonatas. The majority of them were written by the time he was about 32 or 33 years old, actually. And he did not, in fact, write any in the last 5 years of his life. He moved on, focusing particularly on string quartets. Yeah.
Why did he write the sonatas?
Well, certainly the sonata was, by that point, was sort of a standard genre that allowed a composer to sort of show his mettle and to reach a wide audience. Originally, sonatas were sort of associated with amateurs, sort of aristocratic ladies and things like this. So the earliest sonatas in the middle of the 18th century were quite easy in general and quite light and sort of purposely unlearned, so in some ways in reaction to the contrapuntal erudition of J.S. Bach, for instance. By the time you get to Beethoven, of course, he's starting to overthrow that tradition. I mean, even in the very first sonatas, it's clear they're not appropriate for amateurs.
And if you start with the first sonata, how is it like Haydn, and how do you know it is Beethoven?
Well, the first three sonatas, Opus 2, are dedicated to Haydn, and at that point, Beethoven had sort of recently graduated from lessons with Haydn. And you certainly can see Haydn's influence. For instance, Beethoven's approach to humor in music certainly owes something to the older master. Beethoven and humor is not something we tend to put together in a single sentence, but
especially in the sonatas.
Can you give us an example?
Oh, yeah, easily. Opus 2, number 1 is perhaps not the best example of that. I can just play a snippet from Opus 2, number 2, which actually I haven't been practicing recently, but I'll make some sort of attempt at it anyway. It's coming up a little later in my cycle. So what you can hear in this is a tremendous amount of whimsicality in it, particularly in terms of time. The rests are sort of a critical ingredient in this. He'll have a short little motive and then a sort of pregnant pause, and then another motive of a slightly different character, and then another pause, back to the first motive, back and forth between sort of two ideas, kind of in dialogue. And both of them, you know, slightly absurd, very, very short, very light, and tremendous variety also. I mean, sometimes legato, sometimes staccato, sometimes eighth note, sometimes 32nd note, sometimes quarter notes. All of this is something in which Haydn was a pioneer, and it's sort of part of the essence of classicism. I mean, one of the most obvious differences between classical music and the Baroque is the tremendous rhythmic variety and the way in which sections are articulated with pauses. You don't have that in the Baroque when you have sort of a continuous churning of eighth notes or 16th notes or whatever. This is quite the opposite. So, all right, so I'll just do a snippet from 2 number 2, which is a good illustration of this. So it's it's really delightful stuff, and it's not the stereotype of grim old grumpy old Beethoven. Quite the opposite. I mean, there are these distinctive Beethoven touches, the little accents and the abrupt changes of dynamic, the sforzandos and sforzando piano and things like this. He has a lot of those. And, you know, sometimes he uses those for violent purposes, but in this case, he just uses it for sort of waggish purposes.
He gives pretty specific directions in the sonatas?
Yes. There's only one in which he doesn't, which is the Sonatina Opus 49, number 2, which clearly was sort of an exercise for Beethoven. And there are essentially no markings in that one. So he was just sort of figuring out how to write the notes. But for every other sonata, very detailed indications of dynamics of articulation and tempo markings, somewhat less specific. I mean, he doesn't get into sort of the paragraph-long descriptions that you get in Mahler and so forth. Yeah, simple things like allegro and allegro vivace. But other than that, yeah, it's very detailed and very interesting.
And if you had to categorize the early sonatas, besides the humor, besides something that might sound a little bit more classical, more like Haydn, what else would you be listening for that would tell you, if you just heard a few bars of a sonata, that would kind of signal that it might be the earlier side of Beethoven?
Well, as you said, the sort of lighter elements in there. What's interesting about the evolution of Beethoven's writing is that it's not any sort of simple linear process from sort of short and simple to long and complex in the late sonatas. So in fact, some of the longest sonatas are the early ones. So for instance, Opus 7 is you know, very substantial and very, very, very serious in its purposes and very ambitious. Most of the early sonatas, for instance, have four movements, which was unusual at the time, whereas in fact the later sonatas tend to be fewer movements. Three is more typical, and quite a few important ones with just two.
That extra movement would be what, the third movement?
Yeah, typically in Haydn and Mozart, the typical layout is fast, slow, fast. And what happens in early Beethoven is that between numbers 2 and 3, he inserts a minuet or a scherzo. And that's, more in the symphonic tradition. So he was really approaching these sonatas as sort of practice symphonies in a way. And in fact, I mean, a lot of these sonatas predate the symphonies. I mean, even the first symphony was quite a bit later than these early sonatas.
In the early sonatas, do you have the same dynamic range? You know how if you're listening to Beethoven on the radio, you can tell because you have to keep changing the volume dial?
Yes.
And that starts right away, that where you have the really extreme range.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I mean, at one point you asked about things that are specifically Beethoven as opposed to just warmed over Haydn. And immediately you see stuff that's just signature Beethoven, couldn't be anyone else. So, for instance, in Opus 2, Number 1, the very first sonata, the last movement has, as you were suggesting, these tremendous varieties of dynamic marking in a very short space of time. So I'll play the first few bars, and you hear piano, forte, piano, forte, piano, and then a sforzando thrown in, and then some fortissimos, and back and forth. And so that certainly is part of what makes it distinctively Beethoven. Just also the tempestuousness of it. It's in F minor, so it's sort of Beethoven's minor personality, sort of shaking his fist a little bit and asserting his seriousness and his power, even though he's only 25 years old or whatever and just starting to make his way musically in Vienna. So here we go. This is the prestissimo from 2 number 1. I'll do, 32 bars or something. Wanted to do a little bit of that second theme, which has, relative lyricism after the bombast of the opening.
You have to wonder if the instruments were big enough for Beethoven.
Well, that's certainly an interesting and contentious issue. There certainly is a school of thought that, what Beethoven really was sort of dreaming of, in a sense, was bigger pianos, more like what we have today, that he was straining at the leash, at the constraints of the instrument of his day. Now, of course, on the other side, people who say, he wrote for the instruments that existed, not for some imaginary future instrument, and then, the best way to hear his music or to imagine is on the original instruments. So.
And then just retune them after every movement.
Well, yes, or replace them. I mean, particularly after he started going deaf, he would play louder and louder to try and hear himself. And he broke lots of strings. I think even destroyed a few instruments completely.
On the other side from those really tumultuous, tempestuous passages like the one you just played, can you give us an example from the early sonatas of a really lyrical passage or song?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. For instance, the slow movement of Opus 10, Number 1, and it's actually the first time I've played it in 30 years, so...
this is something historical here.
Yes, quite a... sort of a review session for me. Anyway, very serene, very spacious, and, a little influence maybe of Italian style opera in here even, relatively decorated by the standards of Beethoven, who usually didn't go in for florid stuff. So anyway, here's then the second movement of 10, Number 1. Thank you. goes back to the beginning, more or less.
Well, it's the lovely lyrical side of Beethoven.
Absolutely. Every now and then, you know, a distinctive Beethoven touch, a little outburst, a sforzando.
Very chromatic, too.
Surprisingly, yeah. Once again, there's not a simple progression in Beethoven stylistic evolution from, you know, harmonically conservative to harmonically adventuresome. In some ways, there are passages in the late sonatas that are, you know, more conservative than stuff you have in the early sonatas, just from the point of view of harmonic analysis.
Do you find knowledge of Beethoven's life influences the way you play?
The way he played?
The way you play.
The way I play.
Are you aware sort of his life story and his personality and his and everything as you're playing?
Well, it's hard to ignore sort of the heroic, the tragic, the inspiring elements of the Beethoven story. I mean, that's part of his mystique that, you know, he overcame the most crippling ailment that could occur to a composer, deafness. So certainly one derives inspiration and admiration from that story. It's an interesting question. Was his style affected by deafness? And was it deafness that sort of caused the increasing sort of interiority and the individualism in his late style?
But
I think it's a plausible idea that as he became removed from the world to some extent, from normal social interactions, to a degree, and as sort of the memory of the sounds he heard in his youth, as it sort of somehow faded or changed, I mean, it's very hard to imagine, you know, what phenomenologically, what it was like for him, how he experienced these pieces, you know, inside his inner ear. I mean, clearly, obviously, he had, you know, an excellent ear, and in his youth, he composed away from the piano, and, you know, he could hear all this stuff in his head. He could write it down without ever having to consult at a piano to figure out what it really sounded like. And yet, you know, as his tether with sort of the real world of actual sound, as it that got more and more, as those memories became more and more distant. Clearly his perception of it must have somehow been different from yours or mine. It's astounding, though, I mean, that he continued to experiment with, you know, the possibilities of the piano. He continued to use new possibilities as the instrument changed, as the instrument got bigger, as it added notes, as the use of the right and the left pedals as it evolved. He was right in the thick of that evolution. He wasn't stuck with the pianos of his youth. So even though he wasn't hearing these new instruments very well, he was certainly seizing the opportunities and sort of setting the gauntlet of what was possible with these new instruments. And yet he never heard any of it. Sort of mind-boggling.
Yes, the great irony of his life, which makes me suspect that that's why his last words were said to have been, "The comedy is ended." Sort of a big joke on him, in a way.
Yeah.
We'll get further insights into how to play a Beethoven piano sonata when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guest, Christopher Taylor, who is performing a cycle of all 32 of the Beethoven piano sonatas over the course of a couple of months at Mills Concert Hall in Madison. What do we know about Beethoven himself as a performer, as a pianist?
Well, he was certainly an idiosyncratic pianist, I think. At the beginning of his career, in his 20s, shortly after his arrival in Vienna, he was certainly an emerging virtuoso. He had good fingers, and that certainly shows up in his early music. I mean, even the very earliest stuff that survives from when he was a teenager in Bonn. He's, you know, very virtuosic, lots of scales and arpeggios and so forth. He was certainly a show-off, showing off his chops in a more sophisticated way. That shows up in the early sonatas. So, for instance, Opus 2, number 2, is sort of a notoriously showy kind of sonata. In fact, the very first lick in it is sort of infamous among pianists. You have to sit down, your hands are all cold and so forth, and right from the start you have to have, you know, very perfect thirds in your right hand. And so, all right, so I guess I'm going to have to play this now. I've kind of set myself up. It's not particularly showy at first. I mean, only the cognoscenti in the audience will recognize how hard this thing is. But then once we get to measure 12 or something like that, then it becomes blatantly showy. So I'll play that too, and we'll see Beethoven the virtuoso and how this was, you know, an important part of his persona as a young composer. In fact, I think there's even documentation that he wrote a few passages explicitly to make them difficult so that a particular rival of his would not be able to play it.
Did it work?
Yeah, I think he zeroed in on the fact that, you know, rival X isn't able to do very good thirds, so he'd write a huge passage of thirds or whatever.
Yeah, they were difficult times.
So anyway, so maybe this opening was aimed at a rival then.
Nobody was going to be carrying on a polite conversation while he was playing, at least.
Yes, yes. He I don't think, took kindly to the idea of being background music.
I kind of feel sorry for the rival after hearing that passage.
Yeah,
What are some of the other technical challenges that you face when you kind of confronted all 32 and are memorizing them and so on? What are some of the hardest challenges?
The hardest moments. Well, they're spread throughout the whole corpus. I mean, there are difficult things in the early sonatas, like that one. So, I mean, in that page alone, what we hear is, you know, things that are trickier. Thirds, a lot of broken octaves, and sometimes solid octaves also. That was a relatively new technique. There are not too many of them in Haydn or Mozart. But from Beethoven onward, octaves became a staple of the piano technique. So I suppose I should maybe play a passage in solid octaves to just illustrate that. So, for instance, in Opus 7, there's some examples of, some plentiful examples of octaves in there. So let me just find a good spot to start here. So the second theme in the first movement of Opus 7, octaves galore. Starts off, you know, relatively unshowy, but and that'll change. Thank you. right, and that shows off also another thing that he liked a lot, which was sort of tremolos. These figures like that. He was very fond of those, and they often show up in left hands also, where they're variants on the traditional Alberti bass, which was a classical formula for what to do when in doubt with the pianist's left hand. So, you know, it's found a lot in Mozart. I mean, he, right from the easiest sonatas, you know. What my left hand is doing there, that's the Alberti bass. And of course, it can be really deadly, you know, if it's badly played, it really sounds awful. So it's something you have to be careful with. Beethoven was always restless. He wasn't content just to use plain old Alberti basses very often. So he has all sorts of fiendish variants on Alberti basses. And so your left hand has to be pretty fit, and it has to be able to shake in all of these different ways. A good example of that I could play. A varied Alberti bass is the last movement of the Moonlight Sonata.
I was just going to ask you, too, about pieces badly played and Moonlight Sonata.
Yeah, that takes a certain amount of abuse. I suppose anything popular is going to.
Well, there's all kinds of abridged versions as well.
I guess. I'm not really up on that, but I'm sure it's been abused in any manner of ways. Anyway, so in the last movement of the Moonlight Sonata, then, you have at fiendish speed variants on this Alberti bass idea. It's tremendously exciting. It doesn't sound anything like the deadly version of Mozart that I was just doing. So that's an example of the kind of varied Alberti bass. So it's not always just this standard figure. It's also sometimes just a plain old tremolo like that. And that sort of shaking is very typical of Beethoven. There's all sorts of shaking in various ways, and tired arms for the pianist as a result.
Is he that much more tiring than, oh, say, playing a Mozart piano concerto would be?
I think so. I mean, it's longer. It has a wider dynamic range. There's just more calories burned. Not to say that you can be sort of a feeble little wimp playing a Mozart piano concerto. You have to be in shape in order to get cleanness of articulation and in order to make it scintillating. I mean, if you have weak fingers, you're not going to get very far in Mozart or in Beethoven.
Are there just plain more notes in Beethoven?
Yeah, no doubt about it. The density of notes per second is higher.
To what extent do you try to put your own interpretation on a sonata, where if you're playing one particular one that's played a lot, you want to play it in an original way?
Well, it's a delicate business, sort of. Consciously questing for originality is probably not the best viewpoint, the best approach. I mean, certainly you have to listen to recordings of other pianists to sort of get a sense of what's out there and what's been done. But I try not to rely on that too much. I mean, I'm basically, my goal is to develop my own ideas and not get too biased and influenced by the hundreds of other performances that there are out there. So while I'll listen to them, it's not sort of a central part of my forming an interpretation, saying, you know, I like what Richard Good does there, but I better do something different on page 10 because I don't want to sound like a clone. I mean, I think if you just spend time with the score at the piano, experimenting, listening to yourself from different standpoints in a way, then, you know, you're going to come up with something that's different. I mean, just the probabilities that it's going to come out identical to a particular recording are essentially zero. I mean, one in a Google or something.
It'd be very hard to to do it even if you wanted to duplicate even
yes.
perhaps your own sound exactly.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, that, I'm sure, keeps on changing. I certainly have a sense of that, although, of course, I'm not a dispassionate observer of my own playing, but I know it changes with time.
Do you have favorite sonatas among the group?
It's very hard to choose. You know, of course, the ones that are most famous are often that way for a good reason. I mean, they're monumental and they're inspiring and they're important. You know, the Appassionata, the Waldstein, the Pathétique.
Moonlight?
Yeah, Moonlight, too. I mean, it's, you know, incredibly original piece.
Well, I've heard it said because of the way one thing that's different about the Moonlight is that slow acceleration. I mean, it starts with a slow movement and then picks up and then really takes
really
off in the course of three movements.
Yes, yes. I mean, no doubt about it. That was a novel concept and illustrates Beethoven's tendency to move the center of gravity in his pieces closer to the end to make the finale really memorable and imposing and important. In the sonata style of Haydn and Mozart, there's definitely a sense that the first movement is sort of where the real meat of the music is. And it's where the sonata allegro form is typically found, where it evolved. And it, of course, became the most important form of all classical music history, I think we can say. But Beethoven became dissatisfied with the idea that the last movement is kind of a lighthearted little fluffy rondo or something like that. And he wanted to make the last movement really important and really imposing, and the Moonlight Sonata certainly illustrates that.
Would you say that Beethoven, then probably more than Haydn, has a sense of the theatrical in the way he lays out his sonatas?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. I mean, certainly it's not like Haydn and Mozart sort of picked movements at random, you know, said, oh, I've got a nice first movement here, and I've got a nice slow movement, and I've got a nice rondo, so I'll put them all in the same key and I'll publish them under one heading. I mean, certainly they weren't proceeding in any arbitrary way like that. But with Beethoven, you really have a sense that, I mean, he's conceiving of this thing as a totality and as part of a single dramatic gesture. And you see that, you know, right from the beginning. And it's really, for almost all of these, it's kind of inconceivable to imagine one of the movements without the others. Anyway, just back to the question of favorites. You know, I certainly love the old chestnuts. And as I said, they're famous for a reason. But, you know, there's so many gems that are off the beaten path with Beethoven.
One of my favorites was always, I don't know how far off the beaten path, but especially the second movement of the third sonata.
Yes, Opus 2, number 3.
Yeah, there's something wonderfully memorable about the way you're almost pulling those notes out of the air.
Yeah, I suppose maybe I should fill in what you're talking about there.
Luxury, you know, to say, I like this one.
So, it is beautiful, the second movement of 2, number 3. I mean, Opus 2, number 3, which I played the opening of, is, you know, very sort of macho, Beethoven, the virtuoso, thumping his chest. And, you know, as a result, it is kind of a piece that one associates a bit with kind of piano jocks at you know, high school piano competitions and so forth, you know, the young prodigies or whatever, they play Opus 2, number 3 to show that they're really fast and really tough. And so, in a way, I mean, that first movement, and the last movement also, has sort of suffered the same fate to some extent, has a lot of showy tastelessness has been demonstrated in that piece over the years. And so the challenge for an interpreter is to have something that's, you know, is bold and brash without being immature and crass.
But in the second movement,
it's a different game. Yeah, I mean, all of this is redeemed. So, well, I can play it. There are a couple of unusual things about it. For instance, the key, it's in E major, whereas the sonata as a whole is in C major. So it's, you know, sort of a very different color and a different atmosphere, and you know, it's very thoughtful and very dignified after the chest thumping of the first movement. The second theme, I mean, clearly he loved that because he devotes, you know, much more time to it than he does to the opening theme, which is also very beautiful. The second theme, you know, more sort of sighing and yearning, yes, with these sort of appoggiatura figures. Those sort of leaning figures, dissonance resolved. So that's, that movement is a little bit off the beaten path because piano jocks can't do that very convincingly.
I would think it would be emotionally draining to play Beethoven sonata after Beethoven sonata. I'm not talking about technically draining. I'm talking about emotionally, just to go through the ups and downs that are required.
Yes, definitely. I mean, there's such a huge emotional range.
How do you go about arranging them 2, 3, 4 at a time in a concert over the course of 32 sonatas?
Well, that was a very interesting undertaking. One possibility is you just do them in chronological order. You start at Opus 2, number 1, and then 2, number 2, and continue all the way to 111.
They're not necessarily written in that order, though.
Well, that's true. So mostly the opus number reflects when they were written. The major exception is Opus 49, which is much earlier than the number would suggest. But I decided it would be fun to try to arrange them into programs that, you know, illustrated particular interrelationships, but also had some variety. The first approximation, it's nice to have an early, a middle, and a late on a program. Now, I didn't necessarily always achieve that formula, but often enough. So, for instance, the first program I did started with 2, number 1. I felt I had to start with the first one at least, even though there's some scrambling in the order in between. So I start with the first one, and I'm going to end with the last one on April 18th.
You make an effort to provide variety of key?
Well, yeah. Again, not necessarily. I wouldn't want a program that was like E flat major, E flat major, E flat major. But related keys are nice. So that first program starts with 2 number 1, which is F minor, and then 27 number 1, which is E flat major, and then 110 in the second half, which is A flat major. So those are all in kind of the same area, you know, 3 or 4 flats in the key signature, basically. And I think that that had some significance for Beethoven. He felt that particular keys had particular personalities.
Is that true of intervals, too? Does he use certain intervals to certain effects?
I think so. He liked, for instance, rising fourths, and that's something that you find featured quite a bit in those 3 sonatas that I mentioned from my first program. For instance, Opus 2, number 1, starts with a rising fourth, and so the whole thing is so forth. So starts with a rising fourth. In Opus 27, number 1, you also find rising fourths in interesting places, like the theme of the last movement. So that interval. And at the end of 27, number 1, then he has lots of rising fourths. Then in Opus 110, constant rising fourths. So in the theme, of the first movement, that right between those 2 notes, that's a rising fourth. That keeps coming back. So for instance, in the fugue, in the last movement, tons of rising fourths. So that gesture somehow had some particular significance for Beethoven. I don't know if we can pin it down in words, if we can say, you know, it was heroic or optimistic or pessimistic or tragic. I don't know quite what one can say about it in words, but just there's something about that gesture that seems to open up possibilities for Beethoven.
Do you find programmatic moments the way you do in the symphonies where you sort of think birds or you think, you know, some kind of representation?
Not very often. I mean, his music is typically absolute. It's abstract. It's not typically programmatic. I mean, the most blatant exception to that, I suppose, is the Les Adieux Sonata, Opus 81a, where the movements, in fact, have titles. The first movement is Beethoven saying farewell to the Archduke as he flees Vienna in the wake of Napoleon's invasion. And then the second movement is the sadness of separation, the absence. And then the last movement is the reunion and the joy at the end of the period of absence. So, I mean, kind of an abstract theme there. But at the beginning, you know, he's sort of evoking this sense of farewell by using horn intervals, French horn kind of sounds, and hunting horns, and the sense of it sort of creates the sense of distance of, you know, hearing these horn calls, retreating into the remote distance. So so forth. So yeah, that's slightly representational, I guess, those horns. He then, when he gets to the Allegro, he takes that same musical idea, extends it a little, and gives it a sort of galloping rhythm so that it suggests perhaps the horses and the carriages headed out of town, so... So forth. So, that sort of galloping rhythm. And, yeah, he's just obsessed with these horn intervals. So at the end of the movement, he's just sort of piles them on top of each other over and over again.
And our farewell for University of the Air for this hour, unfortunately.
All right. But,
you've promised to come back for an encore, so
happily,
we'll look forward to that. Our guest has been Christopher Taylor, enlightening us about Beethoven this hour, and we'll have more in a couple of weeks. Stay with us. I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach, and I hope you can join us for the next hour of University of the Air. Thank you.